one from this group and one from that group. What about this side? What was one of the movements?
The Cesar Chavez marches.
Okay.
For the labor.
Right. So Cesar Chavez was a big labor movement and labor union kind of guy that tried to help people who were in labor situations be have better situations, their work situations, and also pay and not be treated differently because they were immigrant labor or things like that. And so that's a really big movement in the Southwest, right? And what did you, why did you guys think of that movement? What was one of the things that made you think of it? Why was it in your mind?
I knew his personal car, which is like 98 right now, and I spoke with him at a homeless shelter that we lived at, and he just told me about all the stories that he's gone through, and how he was nonviolent, how he embraced the movement, how Martin Luther King, Cesar Chavez, Kennedy all came together to try to find ways to help, you know.
Yeah. So the stories that everybody hears about this movement is nonviolence, about the nonviolence in this movement, is about the process of trying to get people to mobilize behind what's going on, right? So
we had various other movements as well.
You want to name a couple more?
The labor movement, just in general.
In general.
And the civil rights. I mean, that's a major one that kind of reminds us of what we're up against today, unfortunately. And we're kind of repeating history in the sense that the police is abusing their power and not letting us just peacefully, so we have a right to it.
So the 60, what most people think about when they think about the civil rights movement is the 1954 to 1970 civil rights movement, because believe it or not, there's been more than one civil rights movement in the United States. But the one that they think about mostly, which heroes like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X were all a part of that movement. And again, they remember that nonviolent idea that was put forth by Martin Luther King, and the passiveness that led to people seeing what the injustice that was going on, and that's continued to happen even more with a passive action, with sets of passive actions. Right? What about you guys? What did you guys come up with?
I think we came up with pretty much the same.
So there you go. So you came up with, you mentioned another one, the war, anti-war movement. So movements again, like the Vietnam War. Now we have the movements against these wars, the Iraq War, but we also had other wars since then, that there's been a lot of anti-war movements, including the anti-nuke movement, which is really an anti-war movement as well. And those movements are memorable a lot because of the fact that people were trying to stop us from being in this situation that would eventually end up killing all of us in the long run, if we think about it, right? So the idea of senselessness of wars, which I think people like Ron Paul and other people who are arguing right now that these wars are senseless, are pulling from that idea. And then you just said the ERA, Equal Rights Amendment, which many people actually don't really know that the Equal Rights Amendment was never actually passed. So realistically, in our society, women are legislatively still unequal compared to other protected group classes in the United States. So African Americans are actually a protected class. To be a woman is not a protected class. Because the ERA movement is not, yes. It's only a protected class in certain legislation, yes. But in terms of a blanket amendment, women are not blanketly amended like other groups are, yes. So the other movement that many people think about is the suffrage movement, which is the women's right to vote movement. And that was in the 1948, 1920s to 1920s, right? So the reason I wanted to bring these movements up or to have you think about that is because I wanted you to answer the question of what makes a social movement memorable. So from just talking there, we talked about some things, and there's four things I'd like to point out of what makes a social movement memorable. So one, you started talking about like the ideas that they have, or the idea behind the movement, which we call an ideology. And Eric was on the mic just a little while ago talking about, is this ideology or not? And one of the very key components of a memorable, and we'll later talk about a successful a movement, according to what we've seen in history, is having a clear and presented ideology. And I think one of the things that we're starting to hear, what is being attacked about the movement right now, Occupy movement, is that people are trying to say there is no ideology. They're just a bunch of people, running around trying to stop things or whatever.
I've heard that a lot.
And that, yes, and that's a part of the machine behind the media machine and the 1% machine, if you want to say, that is going to try to present that.
Right?
Because
a
good, effective, is the word we're going to talk about later, movement has to have an ideology. And so the idea of passiveness, peacefulness, peaceful protest, just showing what the injustice is through passivity is, in essence, an ideology. And so let's hold on to that thought, because I want, by the time we finish this talk, to think about what the ideology is for the Tucson Occupy Tucson movement, and come up with some ideas that you can present to each other and in resolutions as an action. Another thing that is important to remember about what makes social movements memorable is the reactions that they inspire, right? People telling stories about Cesar Chavez and the movement are reactions that people do all over the place, did then and they still do now, right? There's also reactions of the civil rights movement when people would see on TV people sitting in line and having water cannon shot on them. Think about what's happened recently with the pepper spray, right? It's the reactions that are inspired by a movement that makes a movement memorable. So intentionality of inspiring reactions is an important thing that the Occupy Tucson movement, or any movement, should be thinking about. What reactions do we want intentionally to have? The methods, or what we call tactics, that are utilized in any social movement is also one of the things that makes a social movement memorable. So nonviolent tactics, or tactics that are institutional in nature versus individual in nature, are things that make are one of the things that make a social movement memorable. So if we can look at social movements that we probably wouldn't think are very memorable, maybe like, say, the counter movement of the smoking lobby to try to get people to smoke, right? To continue to smoke. And so that smoking wasn't harmful for people, right? You can't remember that movement, can you?
It's been very successful.
You think it has been very successful?
Absolutely.
Okay, so what do we have? A lot of people who are
smoking.
A lot of people who are still smoking, but a lot less people who have begun to smoke.
Hard to say. Quantify those statistics.
There's actually some research out there, but it's not as statistically prevalent as.
I mean, they've had a lot of success getting people to smoke.
That's right. So again, the methods that people use are important, right? And the last thing is another thing that we think what makes a movement memorable is the social change that it elicits. So if a movement, if we can attach some kind of social change that we see to an actual, the tactics or the presence of a movement, then that movement is memorable, is more memorable than if we can't attach any specific type of social change to it. Right, so we can say that in the 1960s or the 1970s, there was legislation. There was a lot of change in how businesses discriminated. Right, we can see a lot of different types of social change that occurred, and we can say there was a movement that preceded that social change, and because of that, we can say that movement had some kind of effect and was successful or is memorable.
What did it do? What did it accomplish?
What did it do? What did it accomplish? Right. And these are things that are really important in understanding social movements. People ask, well, what is a social movement? Right? Is a social movement just people coming here and meeting in a park? If everybody just met in this park, would that be a social movement?
No.
Why do you say? What if?
Well, it depends. Do the people communicate to meet together at the park? All together at one time? Or was it just spur of the moment, all of a sudden, people just showed up?
So you're saying, was it an intentional action, an intentional collective action, or was it a coincidental, shall we say, collective action? And you're saying that makes it a social movement, it's an intentional collective action?
Or undefined.
Or undefined. So, but he's arguing that it would be intentional that makes it a collective movement. So if we all decided that we're all going to go buy a ticket to a baseball game and went down to that baseball game, we all intentionally decided to buy that ticket and all intentionally decided to meet at that place for that baseball game. Is that a social movement?
No.
I get
no.
a sense, yes.
You say no, you say yes. Yes. So why do you say no?
Because watching baseball doesn't further humanity.
But it still...
Some people might argue it does. Some people might say it brings together people, families. It creates a camaraderie. It creates citizen... approval, it creates what is it? Where you?
I think baseball is boring, that's my point.
But why do you say yes?
I say yes because the fact that there's a group in society coming together and they're actually taking action together, that unity is powerful and that potential is what we want to tap into, whether it has a direction or not. They're just going to see the game or they're going to see the game with some kind of social justice awareness or not. So
but they're there to receive something instead of promoting something.
Well, in general, wouldn't people say that social movements also, people are there participating because they believe that there's going to be something that they're going to receive in the long run? So, one more thing before I go on.
Yeah, I'm just saying to me, I would have to define social movement as something that betters humanity. Now, of course, there could be negative social movements. Okay. And also, who's to quantify what betterment means, but
so you're doing something that we get caught up in is you're going to define the social movement based on what they how we judge their outcome.
I'm defining what a social movement is by its what if it's successful is determined by whether it helps humanity become better.
So you're saying that's a moral judgment of the outcome. So, for instance, you would say the prohibition movement, which occurred in the United States to stop people from drinking, right? Which eventually people argued was not positive for our society, would not be a social movement because it morally would be judged as something that was negative. And so that's an important thing to talk about too. So moral judgment of the outcome does not lessen its social movement, does not lessen its capacity as a social movement. It just lessens the society's belief as to the outcome about the social movement.
Social movement could be pretty broad.
Yes,
if you want to make it
exactly.
Broad.
So what I want to get to today is try to see that there's a difference between collective action, which social movements do, which a baseball game might be considered a collective action, or to stop prohibition might be considered a collective action. Or everybody coming to a park to make a statement about the 1% is a collective action. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a social movement. Right? All social movements involve collective action, but all collective actions are not social movements. Right? So social movements have to have those components that we talked about. They have to have an ideology that people are following. They have to have objectives related to that ideology, right? That are going to be able to be evaluated and determine whether or not we've met these objectives. Then, hold on for a second, let me go through all the pieces, and then I'll give you. They have to have some kind of tactics related to the ideology that are both, and this is a really important thing to say, both intra-institutional and extra-institutional. And I will come back to those. All right? They have to have tactics that involve both of those. And they have to have a sense of we. We are in this together. Right?
Radical separatists unite.
But that we does not have to mean that we're separate from the people who are not a part of the movement. Right? So one of the things that I heard, and I will say in my personal opinion as I was listening to some of the talk today, is it seems like there's a lot of, we get caught up in the police being them and we being us, because the police are taking actions based on their job. And one of the things that I've been doing lately is working with the different institutions on some of the foundation work that I have, because I'm the executive director of my own foundation. And I will tell you that the police in this city and the fire department and many of the people in the public service are not against you. They are definitely aware of what you are saying, and they are ready to help in the capacity that they can. It just has to be through the correct tactics.
I think a social movement also has to be something where a lot of people get on board.
Mobilized. It's a group of mobilized
people. It's not just 1%. It's right. Like a lot of people. So then it becomes a social movement.
That's a good point. A social movement also has to have people continuously mobilizing toward it. If it's not, it's going to just die off. And that's another thing people are saying. It becomes a fad. It's just a fad. And people are trying to say that the Occupy movement is just a fad. If we just let it die out and they don't have these things, they will just die out and become a fad, right? I belong to a social movement called Burning Man. And people have said that about us. For the last 25 years, we have grown and grown and grown, and we have infiltrated in terms of our social situation structure in ways that has helped benefit our society. And that's what a social movement does.
Right? Sounds like a moral judgment.
It is a moral judgment on my part, because I'm a part of that movement. And everyone should, who's a part of their movement, will have moral judgments. Moral judgments do not disappear because you are a part of a movement. It's just that your movement, your in terms of what we said, the judgment of the outcome of the movement by the people will have a different effect on whether people think it's a social movement or a legitimate social movement or not. Right? Okay. So social movements persist over time. We know that. They can be initiated by a social problem just like this one is, right? And all social movements are either initiated by a social problem, or they are initiated because people want to counter the movement that's initiated by a social problem, right? So a counter movement might be a counter Occupy movement. Like, by say, maybe the 1% might come up with a movement to try to utilize the public spaces for public, benefits to stop occupying from happening.
Ku Klux Klan.
That's a counter, and the Ku Klux Klan is a social movement, right? So we have to understand that those are the way movements work, right? So movements are, there's different types of movements, right? And the types of movements are based on what kind of outcomes we want. And the major outcome that I'll talk about today real quick, social change. So we can have social change in three different ways. Four different ways. If we think about social change, let me ask you, instead of me, what would social change look like? If tomorrow something was this way, and today something's this way, and tomorrow something's that way, what would that look like?
Less
egos in individuals?
Yeah, and then, like, I don't know, just a change in the way people treat each other. Somebody says, spigs. I mean, they wouldn't say that anymore.
So you're saying that saying something, the difference in not saying something or saying something, is change in behavior.
Also, actually,
right? All right.
Ways
people wear clothing?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's...
So if you, when you put on clothes, is that's related to what? What your, at a time is, at a given time. When you get up in the morning, you put on certain clothes.
Well, your culture.
It's culture, but it's also...
I think I meant like trends.
Trends.
That's a social change.
Okay. So trends are social change. Okay. Trends are either trends in behavior, Or I was trying to get to something. Go ahead.
Oh, I didn't want to interrupt. Just, I'd rather not be filmed. Change in the intent, the structure, and the content of the law as Part A, and Part B as perhaps even changes in the recognized upholders of the law as well.
So changes in structure and law are what we call changes in institutions, right? Institutional change, right? So we've got institutional change, which is change in some kind of structure or law or social unwritten or written kind of ideologies that we abide by, right?
You can see a change in values.
Change of values, right? So those are change. Values are also can be seen through our institutions, or they can be seen through our individual behaviors, right? And attitudes is what I was getting to, right? So we get dressed in the morning based on the attitude that we have at a given time, right? So there's what we say in sociology, that there's behaviors, thoughts, and feelings, and within the thoughts, there's attitudes, right, that we have about things. So if we're looking at social change, that's what's going to change. And so when we can change those things either by having individuals adopt new attitudes, or individuals adopt new behaviors, or individuals working with institutions differently, or we can have those changes occur by the institutions actually changing, so that when individuals deal with them, that they have a different way of dealing with individuals, right? So if we think about that, if we think about on a line, or one line going down, is individuals, single individuals, all the way up to all individuals, right? And then we think of the other line this way, going institutions to non-institutions, right? We can then see that there's a little four blocks that we can say. We can either have change that's totally institutional affects all individuals, or we can have change that's institutional and affects some individuals or a few individuals, or we can have change that's affects few individuals and hardly any institutions. Which one of those do you think we want right now? Which one do you...
Make a change when everybody wins.
Yes, so the one that...
Okay.
That
not just a little bit of people.
You're saying the type of change that would have most individuals changed and most institutions changed.
Yes, is there a change like that?
Yes, yeah, okay. That's called revolutionary social change. Revolutionary social change is when we have the majority of people doing it and the institutions going with us, right? Alternative social change is when we have just a few people doing it and a few and no institutions, right? Then we have redemptive social change, where the institutions do it, but we don't, because they redeem themselves. And we have performative change, where the people do it, but the institutions don't necessarily do it. Yes. Okay, so if we think about, an example of where an institution decides to change because it tried to do something, but the people did not go with it. Okay? So right here in Arizona, several years ago, how many people lived here over 6 years? Okay. I think it was about 6 years ago. The A on A Mountain. Do you remember the A on A Mountain used to be painted
white?
Any color that it could be painted, people would just go up there at any time and paint.
Right.
Well, it was customary for the athletic team to go and paint it on like homecoming or something,
yeah.
But it was generally white. And right. Then 911 came along and they painted it red, white, and blue.
Right. Oh, yeah. And on that year, our legislatures, without any asking anyone, decided that they wanted to make a law that said that the A could only be painted one color. You see, most people don't know this, right?
The kind of thing they're concerned about.
Right. And so that's an institutional change, right? Because that's a law where the institution was made and didn't include any of the people and not for the people. right? And really just for them to have power, right? Well, people just decided that they weren't going to buy by that law because most people didn't even know about that law. And people still painted the DA, and the police didn't enforce it because the police were like, hey, because the police are like, it makes no sense to enforce this law, right? So in that sense, you've got an institution that's done something that has no bearing on the people, and the people aren't doing it, so they don't go ahead and change the law back or get rid of that law. So they reform to meet the people's demands in some sense, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Can anybody else think of something on a national level that's reformative, where the people just did not go with something and it was tried? They tried to
prohibition.
That's definitely one. They had prohibition for I don't know how many years. They had a prohibition amendment, right? And we also have. I mean, if we think about recently, the Defense of Marriage Act went through, and then states just started to say no. We're going to do our own process. And then that process started leading to them saying, no, we're going to define marriage the way we want to. And so that's, now what would happen, the reformative change would be that the federal government would turn around and say the Defense of Marriage Act is useless, so get rid of it. Right. And like the ban on gay people in the military. That's kind of, as well as the ban on gay people in the military. As well as the, what are the other laws that recently got taken off the books from Jim Crow era? There was a bunch of sodomy laws and some other things that they just said, these are totally out of date. Okay, so I guess, go ahead.
Another point is, if a law is not enforced, it should be taken off the books.
Yes.
Because it encourages lawlessness.
And it encourages use, discriminatory use. Yeah. And that's why those other laws, like the sodomy laws, were taken off the books. Because really what happened in the arguments in this Supreme Court with sodomy laws was the argument was that these were not, about a behavior that was not done by the populace. And the lawyers argued, that's not true. Married people involve themselves in lots of different types of sexual situations, right? So what happens is we have micro changes and macro changes. And if we think of macro change, social change, those occur at the institutional structural levels, and the micro change occurs at the individual and small day-to-day levels.
Right? Would it ever be the opposite of presidential?
Where?
The macro level would happen at the individual level? Like, say,
well, macro changes affect individuals. But micro changes don't necessarily affect institutions. Okay, so what I was going to say is to talk to you a little bit about the tactics, because remember those four things I said are important, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about tactics and then have you break up and to use some of this to kind of talk about what you guys might think about as an ideology and how you can use tactics. And framing of your grievances. That was another thing I wanted to present today. So when we think of tactics, I said there's two types. There's intra-institutional and extra-institutional. And what would you think an extra-institutional tactic would mean? Extra-institutional means what? If you look at that word.
Outside
of the institution.
Okay.
Right. Like... So outside an institution would be like, say if we didn't like the education system, so we boycotted the education system, or we picketed around school. That's not stopping the institution. The institution is still going, and we're just making a scene of our dislike of the institution. That's an extra institutional action. This would be what? An extra institutional action.
Don't you think this is extra institutional movement, let's put it that way. But don't you think if that goes so big, bigger than the institutional, inside, bigger, huge bigger, So what they're doing is, no matter what the rest of the people think or want, they want to do what they want to do. So who cares about the rest of the outside? Don't you think that it doesn't make sense in that case? That
no, it does. What we're saying is that the movement is not institutional or extra-institutional. It's the tactics that a movement uses. A movement will use, should use, both of them, is what I'm suggesting to you.
Yeah, okay. But we can have so many influence that they will have to be forced to change.
You would have to be in a situation where you grow and mobilize enough people so that you actually can have an impact on an institution to do the reform, right? But that happens few and far between without using both types of actions, okay? There was a hand, I saw.
Well, it seems that we will institutionalize anything, including a movement victory.
Right.
So, you know, right. The moving target and to go outside the institution often is like a thicket, in my experience, that you find yourself looking for the best place to take a movement in the extra institutional mode, and it isn't always so easy to find. Sometimes when it is found, you realize that there's footprints ahead of you, or that, you know, there are people who are blazing a trail, building an institutional modality for that very activity that is invisible. So reinventing the wheel is often something that happens.
What I'll bring to you is not trying to reinvent the wheel by using those two, but to work together, to have the two work together, because the best movements actually have those two actions, and they have actually factions who are designed to do those two different actions in concert with each other, so that they actually have a very intentional outcome associated with it. Because remember, I said you have to have an ideology and be objectives of your outcomes. And that's kind of what we're talking about.
Well, I think a good example of what we're talking about now is what was brought up at the general meeting, where one of the ladies was saying, it seems like if we go along with the city council and have at one park where they want us to do,
right,
that's a bad thing, because then we're becoming institutionalized.
Right. So
that's the difference between a grassroots movement and an institutionalized.
That's why I'm saying that good social movements or successful, effective social movements do both. They don't just do one. So you do the extra institutional is this kind of thing, and going to another park or whatever, and actually working with maybe the city council on it, but also doing intra institutional. So you also have situations where there's actions that are occurring inside the institution to stop and disrupt the institution. So intra-institutional actions would be like going into city council and taking it over, or going into a bank and not stealing, but taking it over in some way, or stopping its operations from happening without them knowing it's going to happen.
So
we're changing the law is institutional change. That's the outcome. Remember, the actions are what you're doing in your as a collective action. So, and some examples and really effective examples of intra-institutional actions that are occurring right now are what they call flash mobs, where people plan these really intense things that happen inside stores or inside government buildings, where everybody goes in and does the right way legally. They all enter and they have their IDs, and then at a certain moment in time, they all plan for something to happen at that time. And when it happens, the institution is totally shocked, and they're totally floored. They are stopped. Everything is stopped. And in a matter of moments, the people have left, and they have this situation where they've been flash mobbed, and police don't know about it. It takes police a while to get there, right? It takes the institution a longer time to figure out how to recoup. It's kind of like, have you seen if you put a line of ants and you put a rock in the middle of a line of ants? What happens? They go crazy. They don't know what to do. Okay. So the point is to have those two types of actions is really important. And the factions I studied in my master's program, I studied the white racialist movement. And the white racialist movement, and I looked at grievance frames, which is another thing I wanted to present to you today. Grievance frames, grievances are what we are arguing against. So what would you say a grievance of the Occupy movement is?
Corporate money going to politics.
Corporate money going to politics. What would you say a grievance of the Occupy movement is?
Homelessness.
Homelessness.
The money goes into the banks, controlled by politics,
so
everywhere in the world. That's what it is.
Corporate money controlling politics.
Yeah, whatever we do, you work hard, guess what? You own more and more and more. So you have to work more for others. So what about the rest? So that's what it is. England, U.S., France.
All right. I just wanted to make sure you got what he said. All right, that's good. So you're saying corporate money is controlling the banks, right?
Yeah, but the banks actually control the government because they have the money. They financial the wars. They financial
so
everything.
So the banks create money and then control them. Right, that's what you're saying.
The Federal Reserve, it does. Just to name, that's the most important problem.
So go ahead.
Stop the dehumanization of economic and political refugees across the border.
Okay, so stop the dehumanization of people who are crossing the border for legitimate means to work.
Yeah, that would be a true sign.
That would also be great.
I just would say, as a general beginning frame, with the October 15th declaration from Occupy Wall Street, there is a declaration. It does end, but these grievances are not all-inclusive. And many people, like for the first few days of Occupy Tucson, people wouldn't even understand, yes, these are grievances.
Right.
That's what they're called. They're grievances.
But people don't know those grievances. A lot of people don't know those grievances that are out here. The people who are driving past going, get a job. They haven't read the Occupy Wall Street grievances.
That's why we should be talking about
this. This is why I'm talking to you about this today.
But the fact is they don't even know why this all started. They don't even know because they don't read other than what happened in the bars and all that stuff.
So this is why...
That's why all this happened. Or they're going to inaugurate a theater.
Mic check! Mic check! To the owner of the Toyota pickup truck. Your headlights are on.
Mine. All right. Is it white?
So
that was a good collective action.
The one of the thing
over
I've
here.
Made, thing I want to talk about in grievance frames
it's over
is
here.
That
it's over here right now.
A good social movement understands that how your grievance frames resonate with the people who you are trying to mobilize is important. Because any good social movement, like we said, needs to mobilize people. Needs to get people from out there to join the cause and get them to be a part of the cause. In whatever way, shape, or form, extra-institutional, right? So, what I found in my studies is that when we talk about resonating has to be with people's personal ideas and values. Even if you don't agree with someone's personal ideas and values, if you want them to mobilize with you, right, you have to somehow talk to them about the grievances in a framework that will get them to resonate with their own personal self. So if I have a friend who's rich, and I'm trying to get him to understand the idea of corporate money ruling our society and delegitimizing our freedoms, then I have to be able to talk to him about that grievance in a way that's not going to resonate with me trying to take his money away. Right? And other ways of doing that. So
my son just lost his job as chief operating officer for derivatives trading with Bank of America.
Uh-huh.
He says, "Dad, I've been working in the belly of the beast."
See, so you must have talked to him in a way that
he
made
already
it resonate
knows that.
What is problematic about what he's doing or what he's involved in.
I think a prime example of that would be
Tom Paine's, Thomas Paine's Common Sense. Reading that, it's like there's a lot of angles that he came at that he didn't believe in himself, but it was to address people at large who would be motivated by what they were hearing.
Right.
Very interesting to read that, knowing that he didn't believe in some of those things.
It's an amazing, powerful tool that any social movement should use. I studied, like I said, white racialist movements, and their grievance frames went from one continuum, which was white people are superior because God created us this way, to the other end of the scale, that we are a culture that has aspects that we wish to preserve and we are very proud of. And just like any other culture that has aspects that it wishes to preserve and be proud of, we want to do that for our children. And everything that we do is based on that. No one can argue with that end, right? But understanding that you're using it to their end is what's important, and all social movements need to be able to understand that.
You're Homo sapiens, just like me.
Yes, I am.
I study your history.
We're actually Homo sapiens sapien, according to the latest.
Yeah, well, whatever. So it doesn't really matter, you know what I'm saying? We're all planet here, but actually space races. But I'm not in the CIA program or anything like that.
Okay.
Another ship. But anyway, we were planet here over the years, and it's migratory, okay?
Okay.
And it actually had a close contingent connection with the Chinese.
Okay.
And there's a folks there, just like Mr. Jared and Fluxus and stuff like that before all this meat and bullshit.
Okay. So now I would say, how would you be able to frame that in a way to people that would resonate with what you're trying to do with the movement? If you're trying to get everybody to see that we're just all
one. Well, academia is old. It's old, though. Laws across the universe are always there.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is we've got to talk about anything, we've got to be able to and connect it to the movement, right? What we're saying, connect it to people's ideologies, their own personal ideologies, and have it so that it resonates with them.
Can you think of Tea Party in that context?
The Boston Tea Party or the Tea Party
here? Okay. Tea Party.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they have done that. They have utilized things that resonate with our thought processes, like the Tea Party, right, which is a revolution, right, and which is another thing that many people say social movements can't be without, which is revolution. Not violent revolution, but just revolting against something, right? And said, you know, hey, we need to revolt against this major dominant ideology, but utilizing that revolt idea to kind of get people to think their ideology is better than the other, when it is actually just a different framework of it. And that's what good social movements do. They have a political end or an end that people would see as legitimate, and they have a delegitimate end. And usually the delegitimate ends are the ones who are given the job of doing the intra-institutional work that disturbs, and the extra-institutional are given to the ones who are political. That's usually the way it works. Where you had your hand up. Hand up. Hand up.
Could you speak a little bit more? I'd like to see a little bit more detail on ideology.
Okay.
Because I think it's a very under... and also it does seem like an aspect of what you're talking about is PR spin and propaganda.
Yes.
So we need to unpack that a little bit.
Right. So I think... yes.
This may speak a little bit to the propaganda kind of thing. Really, I think the success of a movement like this, a social movement, has to be first based on the peace movement, and I'll tell you why. Because in Qigong philosophy, if you're upset, if you're angry, for example, you cannot think clearly. So in order to resonate with the person, you have to have this inner peace. So without your peace, you cannot resonate with another person and show them the wisdom of your ideology.
But at the same time, I think as a point of talking about the resonance, we would have to be able to get that across to people who are warriors. and people who are warriors, it still can utilize that, right?
Not necessarily, because you're never going to convince 100% of the people. There's
right.
people that are irrational that you're wasting your time talking with, for example. But to have a successful social movement, you have to capture a lot of the people's resonance.
But also, a successful social movement would never say, in some sense, that it is that there are people who we shouldn't talk to. All people are rational in some sense, which is that they're self-benefiting. Everyone will rationally do something that they feel they get benefit from. So if we can make something sound like and legitimately be embraced by someone as something that's beneficial for them, they are more likely to do it. So if I'm a warrior and I like shooting things. If you can convince me or get me to embrace the idea that utilizing that in a different way is going to benefit me, then I'm more likely to do it. Right? And so that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I just dropped by. I'm very inspired by what's going on here. It's beautiful. I'd like to say one thing before I leave, and that is our whole system is built on grievances. I don't like what you're doing. They don't like what I'm doing. We need to say what we're for. Basic human values. The things we all want is love and respect. And if we can approach it on that level, there's nobody who doesn't want that.
There you go. And that's what ideology has to be based on.
That's what really matters. It's human beings that matter.
In terms of ideology, I would say we've got to probably wrap this up soon. In terms of ideology, I think the Occupy movement, as you guys are Occupy Tucson are working, I think, one, you have a really good opportunity here because of the political opportunity structure is a lot more welcoming to you than to in other safe cities right now. So an ideology could come out of this place that would really, really, if it is an ideology that worked with the institutions and worked with and included people like the police and the fire department, and we really came up with one that would resonate with the benefit of all the people, I think it would be a really positive thing. And when we're talking about that, you know, things about...
The police want love and respect,
right,
too.
Right, love and respect. But then those things are what I would say are conceptual, but actually moving from the concept of love and respect and actually talking about indicators of respect. So when people like a political candidate says, you know, we're going to bring people home from the war, you know, because we are respecting families and trying to make sure that these families are not torn apart or not any longer or not losing members of their family for senseless, political gain. That's an ideology that people can get on board with, right? So, but if somebody says just, an ideology of we should stop the wars because we're losing money, we're putting too much money into it. That's a different ideology, right?
Sure, can I say something?
Yeah.
War is a difference. There are the doggone bank accounts. And what they do is they kill a certain amount of population all the time. That was killed for... JFK was killed for...
JFK was killed too.
And Pansy, they were extending the war. It's all eugenics. So just stay out of harm's way. That's what
I'm saying. Well, and no matter whether it's eugenics or any other thing like that, it's still utility, right? And if it's utility, utility is less ideological to people when it doesn't involve them. If it's a utility that's just about me getting something from you, it's less likely to resonate with people than if it's about all of us benefiting, right?
Are we presently speaking about what Jeff wanted to talk
about? Ideology.
We are talking about ideology.
Yes, that's what we're talking about.
And are we talking about it in general or about in relation to this?
We're talking about it in general, and I'm going to leave you with you breaking up and talking about some things that you can specifically talk about in terms of building an ideology. You know, so that I think that's really important. So to talk about the an ideology that will resonate with as many people as possible, talk about an ideology that includes institutional and extra-institutional action, that includes the what we talked about, individual, like as many individuals that are going to be affected, as well as institutions that are going to be affected, how you're going to do that, and what you know, what you're doing in relation to trying to achieve those ends. And that's what an ideology is. It's just a statement about, you know, what you're trying to do. The 60s ideology of trying to be non-violent, because we're being non-violent because we do not want to promote violence as a means of change, but we want to promote togetherness and
love and respect.
Freedom, love and respect as a means
of change.
That's
what Dr. King was about.
That's right. And so that's the kind of, what is the ideology of Occupy Tucson? We want to promote this as a getting to this end by doing these things, right? And that's what you're trying to get at. Those are the kinds of things. And how are you going to, and once you say respect and equality, what are you going to indicate that with? How are you going to walk up to, are we going to, we're going to indicate that by going into our institutional actions in a proper way. So we're going to, you know, do resolutions. We're going to offer resolutions. We're going to go to meetings in our groups, but we're going to go there. We're going to be silent until a representative gets up and talks. Or we're going to do flash mobs, whatever, you know, whatever way. But you've got to have an ideology and actions that fit that ideology. Is that cool? Is that good? All right. Thank you for allowing me to help. If you guys have any more of these details you want, I will be free to come back this week and do a...
This isn't enough.
Okay.
We want more.
All right. No problem.